Lecture 12, Agamemnon's Grave.
In this lecture, we're going to continue the story of Heinrich Schliemann, one of the last of what you might loosely call the heroic archaeologists, a man, as we saw in the last lecture, who had an obsession with the historical truth of Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. In a way, I cannot blame him, because they are such vivid and lucid epics with fascinating, compelling storylines that it's very tempting to wonder if they are, in fact, the literal historical truth. As we'll see in this lecture, Heinrich Schliemann's obsession with Homer didn't end with Troy. The first part of the lecture now describes what happened after he discovered Troy, when he went to Mycenae in southern Greece in 1876. We describe his excavations at Mycenae, where he found the gold-laden so-called shaft graves, and claims he has found the tomb of the Homeric king Agamemnon. In the second part of the lecture, we'll assess the significance of Schliemann's discoveries at Mycenae and place them in a modern archaeological context, showing that the shaft graves were, in fact, from much earlier Bronze Age times. And we'll also take a look at his excavations at the site of Tiryns, down on the plain of Argos. As I said, Schliemann's obsession with Homer didn't end with Troy. He was fascinated not only by the siege itself, but by the characters in the epics, with King Agamemnon and his queen Clytemnestra, with Odysseus and the other epic, magnificent, larger-than-life figures who peopled Homer's epics. And the truth of the matter is that Heinrich Schliemann himself liked to think of himself as a larger-than-life figure. He was, in the parlance of the 20th century, a classic entrepreneur. He knew what he wanted, he was bubbling with ideas and ambition, and went for the goal he wanted, whatever the cost. Troy had given him a taste of fame and of some academic acclaim. Now he was looking for more, and the logical place for him to go was the rock-girt citadel at Mycenae in southern Greece. Legend says that Mycenae was Agamemnon's palace, his citadel. Was this in fact true? This, to Schliemann, was a logical next step, to go to Agamemnon's homeland and attempt to find not only the place where he lived and ruled, but the place where he died. Schliemann was not the first person to work at Mycenae, to look at the site. One of the themes which we're going to get into in this course later on is the issue of the foreign archaeologist against the local. Because all too often the history of the discovery of archaeology as a whole and of the lost civilizations in particular is a story of the achievement of foreigners. And all too often the often important deeds of local archaeologists, Egyptians, Greeks, Cretans, and others, are ignored in the rush of publicity which cover people like Heinrich Schliemann. And so was the case at Mycenae. In fact, Greek archaeologists had fossicked around there and done some excavation. But Schliemann, having had considerable trouble getting permits from the Greek government, because they were well aware of the furor over Troy, eventually started work there in 1876. Mycenae, which is a popular tourist destination, is a magnificent site in a magnificent setting. It comprises, really in basic terms, two parts. One part are some beehive tombs in the area outside the entrance of the main citadel. Mycenae itself, palace we now know, a Mycenaean palace, fortified with large walls built of huge boulders, with an ornamental gate, with above it the figures of two lions, is the main focus of the site. This was the palace of the chieftains who ruled there. To Homer, this may have been the place of Agamemnon. To Schliemann, it was his job to prove it. So his first excavations were inside the palace, because Schliemann was absolutely convinced that the grave of Agamemnon lay inside these massive stone fortifications. As I said in the Troy lecture, Schliemann always followed his instincts. He went right to the core of the problem. So he started digging in his classically rough, large-scale way at an area just to the right inside the entrance. He soon found a circular structure of double stone slabs with what appeared to be tombstones laying nearby. He worked on for 4 months, steadily, slowly. And in the soft earth under the circle, he found 5 graves. These 5 graves contained 15 skeletons, literally smothered in gold. These treasures from Mycenae, from the graves which are known as the shaft graves, rivaled the discovery of Tutankhamun's sepulchre in 1922, which we will describe in Lecture 19. In fact, it was the most spectacular discovery archaeologically, after the Assyrians probably, in the 19th century. The highlight was delicately hammered golden death masks with clipped beards and moustaches, which lay over the heads of some of the skeletons. In some ways, Schliemann was absolutely the worst person to find this material. He was in a hurry, he was anxious for publicity, and he was ruthless in his pursuit of what he thought were the Homeric graves. With his brilliant flair for publicity, he arranged for none other than the London Times, the ultimate arbiter of public opinion in the late 19th century, to carry almost daily progress reports on the excavation. In the Times, and in a telegram to the King of Greece, which of course was published in those days, the telegram was the web of the 19th century, he announced the finding of what he called Agamemnon's grave. And the public believed him. It's very interesting today that there is a steady drumbeat of announcements of discoveries in all fields of archaeology and in other sciences announced in the newspapers. Many of these, which result from papers published in such journals as Nature and Science and other prominent outlets, announce important finds. All too often, unfortunately, these finds are hyped. Hyped to be of global importance. Why? In many cases, the institutions whose faculty or scientists have done the research see endless fundraising possibilities in publicity. Their model ultimately comes from Heinrich Schliemann, who was the first person who really used publicity to publicize his excavations, not because he needed money, but because he sought legitimacy, he believed in what he found, and his ego was involved. He was doing important things. So he shared his finds with the world. It was, in terms of public relations, a triumph. Several monarchs, including the King of Brazil, followed his excavations. Some visited the site. All of them marveled at his spectacular discoveries. Even those who had scoffed at his extravagant claims were forced to take Schliemann's discoveries at Mycenae very seriously, simply because the material he found was so spectacular. Today, we treat many of his claims with considerable suspicion. There has even been a suggestion, which is unproven, and no one knows if there's any truth in it at all, that he caused the golden masks to be built, or manufactured, and then planted them in the burials. That seems a little far-fetched, but so far nobody has done metallurgical tests on the material in the Athens Museum to prove this allegation right or wrong. But it's only fair to say that Schliemann, given the record of the treasure of Priam, was capable of more or less anything to support his ideas. As the excavation continued, he remained absolutely convinced that he had found the graves of Agamemnon and his companions. The point being, again, it's an archaeological phenomenon. People tend to get bees in their bonnets. And, for example, you want to find the tomb of Agamemnon, and you go digging, expecting to find it. And when you find a skeleton covered with gold and a whole lot of royal burials in a narrow area, and make no mistake, these definitely were aristocratic and royal burials, you say, aha, I have found Agamemnon. I am right. Notice the word I. This was Schliemann. His ego, his whole life was bound up in his conviction that Homer was true and that he had found it. And if you think that way about him, it makes it a little easier to understand all the hoopla over Troy and all the hoopla over Mycenae. His conviction that he had found Agamemnon spilled over into a book which he published on Mycenae in 1878. It's not a very good book. It's little more than a diary of the excavations and an essay in which he expounds his conviction that he had found the Homeric heroes. The public loved it. The monarchs loved it. The German experts, his colleagues, immediately disputed his finds. They said, that in fact these burials, and they accepted them as royal burials, were much earlier than the time of the Homeric epics. That they belonged to the Bronze Age, very much earlier. So they couldn't be the graves of Agamemnon. And they even said that they thought that Agamemnon was a fictional king. This did not please Schliemann. Considerable disputes with the Greek government and local archaeologists surrounded the Mycenae excavations, and Schliemann eventually moved on. He returned partially to Troy, and he also turned his attention to the nearby stone-girt citadel of Tiryns, down in the lowlands near the modern city of Napoleon. Napoleon is a charming little port and town, and it's well worth visiting to see the magnificent Venetian castle, which is on a high hill above the town. It is the ultimate expression of a castle. You should really go and see it, because nearby, and it's a short cab ride, is Tiryns. Tiryns, like Mycenae, is a citadel. It was famous even in antiquity. The Greek writer Pausanias, or Pausanias, depending on the pronunciation you like, had described it as one of the wonders of the world. Its huge boulders, which form its fortifications and walls, piled up as giants. Schliemann used Homer to find Troy, but he also always used the classical writers like Pausanias and others as his guide. He assumed that the classical writers, like Homer, were accurate recorders of the past. If he had gone to Egypt, he would have assumed that the Greek writer Herodotus, who was famous for his gossip and his fanciful stories, was the truth. And he would have then gone dug to find out the truth of Herodotus. So he went to Pausanias. And from Pausanias, he went to Tiryns 10 years after Mycenae in 1886. By this time, and this is where a thread in Schliemann's life should be introduced, archaeological world was changing. there were more professional archaeologists, especially in Germany. The study of classical archaeology was assuming a new complexity and sophistication thanks to the German work on the island of Samothrace and also at Olympia. And Schliemann, in a way, was becoming an odd person out. He was more and more being labeled as an irresponsible adventurer, as somebody who was looking for headlines rather than for science. Because the shift in opinion was coming. It started in with the academics, and in this century it moved into the public. The notion that information was more important than really spectacular discovery. As a result, he became somewhat isolated. But this didn't deter him when he came to dig at Tiryns. Again, he worked on a large scale. At Tiryns, the citadel walls, according to Pausanias, assembled by giants, are massive. They girdle this low hill. There really wasn't much Schliemann could do with that, but inside was an area where he unearthed a palace. This palace had thick stone walls. It stood inside the fortifications, complete with an outer courtyard, stores, and workshops. And here we come to the tragedy of Schliemann. He observed casually that the walls had once been decorated with fine wall paintings. He also observed that clay vessels he found at Tiryns in the palace, in the storerooms, resembled those at Mycenae. He remarked that there were some geometric designs on these pots, similar to those found in clay vessels on the island of Crete, and even further afield in the eastern Mediterranean. But he destroyed most of the evidence that could have thrown light on this. For example, much later on, in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, excavation at another palace at Pylos on the western shores of southern Greece revealed a palace where the wall paintings were recovered meticulously and could be at least partially reconstructed. Even Arthur Evans on Crete found palace paintings in his excavations 20 years later and was able to reconstruct them. Schliemann was in too much of a hurry and didn't bother. Here again, large-scale, crude excavation aimed to make spectacular discoveries destroyed so much. Because one of the big things that we'll find at the very end of the 19th century, and this was already beginning to happen in Schliemann's day, was an increasing realization that a tremendous lot of information comes from small objects. When I talk about this, I go way back in prehistory, and I talk about a Stone Age camp, which two Belgian archaeologists found in a sandy clearing at Meer in northern Belgium. All it consisted of was a scatter of stones around a hearth. Some dozens of feet away, a boulder surrounded by chipped stone. And from that, they reconstructed a complete picture of how a stone worker had got up from this camp in about 6,000 BC, walked across to this boulder, sat down, chipped some stone to make stone knives. He was then later joined by a second stone worker, who also did some stonework. And also they fashioned some bone tools. One of those two stone workers was left-handed. And they reconstructed this from the direction of the flakes on the artifacts, from the distribution of the artifacts on the ground, by refitting the stone to the cores from which it came. That's the level of fine-grained archaeology we see today. That's the level of archaeology that was beyond the comprehension of Heinrich Schliemann and the pioneers, and began to be thought about a bit in the 1880s and 90s in Egypt and elsewhere, as we shall see. So he lost more than he recovered. Towards the end of his life, Schliemann was absolutely convinced that he had found a widespread ancient civilization, hitherto unknown, perhaps of Asian origin, which had flourished on the Aegean islands, and especially on Crete and on the mainland. That's as far as he could go. Today, a century or more later, we know a great deal more. We know, for example, that Schliemann's German critics were correct. The Mycenaean gold-laden shaft graves were not those of Homeric kings and princes, who, if they ever lived, lived much later. But they were the graves and sepulchres of much earlier Bronze Age chieftains. One shouldn't be surprised that Heinrich Schliemann equated Mycenae with Homeric heroes, because his whole approach to archaeology dictated that you took history and it led you into the past, that Homer led you back to home, to Troy or to Mycenae. Today, we look at it completely differently. For instance, we now have far more accurate chronological methods, not only radiocarbon dating, which was developed in the 1950s, which we'll talk about later, but also the use of artifacts of known age and sites of known age as far away as Egypt to date precisely civilizations in distant lands, because pottery from, say, Mycenae was traded to Egypt. It turns up in Middle Kingdom villages in Egypt, which can be dated very accurately from inscriptions and from the accurate chronology of ancient Egypt. So for the first time, we know that Mycenae was the center of a widespread Bronze Age civilization, and today, thanks to accurate chronologies, we know it flourished from about 1500 to 1200 BC, long before Homer's time. What, in fact, Heinrich Schliemann found was the Mycenaean civilization. This was a civilization based not on great palaces, on great cities, but on palaces and citadels. It was a patchwork of powerful, ever-competing chiefdoms who traded, negotiated, and fought with one another. They had bronze weapons, and in some respects, I suspect the political landscape was somewhat similar to that described by Homer. And there's no question that there are folk memories of the Bronze Age in Homer's tales. Remember, these were recited, maybe with a lyre, but they were recited. So they are drawing on all sorts of oral traditions. And back when Homer was writing, probably there were folk memories which are much more vivid than they are now. The other thing that's very interesting about Mycenae now is we know a great deal about it, in part due to a remarkable Bronze Age shipwreck found off southern Turkey at Uluburun. We know that this civilization was in contact with many distant eastern Mediterranean lands. It obtained copper from Cyprus, tin from Turkey, ivory from Syria, ebony, which is a hardwood, from Egypt, and so on and so on. The list goes on and on. What did it trade in exchange? Olive oil, wine, much of it carried in the most beautifully painted, distinctive Mycenaean jars. In fact, Schliemann is perfectly correct. You find Mycenaean pottery in lots of places. And in that point, his work was important. For the first time, people were looking at the design of pottery in various places and beginning to plot distributions of ancient societies. And above all, Mycenae was in touch with the island of Crete. This, as I said, was a palace-based society. The palace was a product of a rugged land, where agricultural land was in short supply, and much depended on wealth obtained from commodities that could be grown in Greece. Vines and olives. And vines and olives occupy different ecological niches on hillside and valley. So the result is you can grow both. But one of the most important things archaeologists learn very early on is that you may never find the vines or the olive oil, but somehow you have to transport that stuff from one place to another. And the way you do it is pots. And it's clear from the distribution of mining Mycenaean potsherds in the bottom of the sea, in Greece and elsewhere, that these materials were traded very widely indeed. What Schliemann's shaft graves contained were the remains of the powerful chieftains who presided over this intensely competitive landscape of competitive city-states. They were warriors. They were traders. They were local kings. They espoused violence. We know little about their religious beliefs, but they certainly weren't those of Homer, with Zeus and Athena and all the rest. And they were farmers. But their main living came from reaching out to other lands. Because the other thing that came out of Schliemann's excavations, which is of critical importance and became something very central to our understanding of the early civilizations, was that people began to realize that ancient civilizations were interconnected. That Greece traded with Crete. That Crete traded with Egypt. That Mycenae traded with the Aegean Islands. That there were connections between all these eastern Mediterranean lands, sporadic sometimes, more continual at other, based mainly on the trade of basic commodities, gold, copper, tin, olive oil, timber, wine, and so on. And that you could not understand any of these civilizations in isolation, because they interacted with each other, not only commercially, but militarily and diplomatically, which is why cuneiform was important, because it became the lingua franca. And some tablets found by Flinders Petrie, which we'll talk about later, actually reveal how widespread this diplomacy was. And Schliemann began to realize dimly that Mycenae was bigger than he thought. It was a widespread phenomenon, even if he still thought of Homer. And about the time of his death in 1890, he was beginning to turn his attention to the island of Crete, the large island in the southern Aegean, where, Homer said, the legendary king Minos had ruled over a powerful kingdom, and where also the classical legend of Theseus and the Minotaur, half-human, half-beast, originated. The notion that the Minotaur lived in a maze under Minos's palace. Schliemann had heard rumors of a maze of buildings at a place called Knossos, on the north side of the island, near the modern town of Heraklion. In his characteristic ruthless, fast-moving way, he went over to Crete and attempted to buy the site so he could dig it. The landowners were a patchwork of different people who didn't like each other. He failed to buy it, partly because he was too impetuous, partly because they didn't want to sell it, because they thought there was treasure there, and partly also because of the extremely volatile political situation on the island, which was chafing under Turkish rule. And shortly after Schliemann died, civil war broke out, and very vicious it was indeed. So perhaps, fortunately for science, Heinrich Schliemann died before he could acquire the excavation rights to Knossos and bulldoze his way into the Minoan civilization of Crete. Schliemann's death marks the passing of an era in the discovery of ancient civilizations. His archaeology was an intensely personal crusade, conducted with Homer in one hand and a spade in the other. The sheer enthusiasm of the man wrested discoveries from the ground. He's a fitting person to end the first part of this course with, because, as he grew older, a new generation of much more professional researchers, part of them, many of them inspired by his work, archaeologists like Flinders Petrie of Egypt and Arthur Evans, who was to excavate in Knossos and unearth the Minoans, changed archaeology forever. And we will describe the impact of their work on early civilizations starting in Lecture 13.